time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 14th, 2018. If you've been following the Tour de France, it's been quite an interesting week so far. World champion Peter Sagan was sporting his usual green jersey when this show was put together, and a young man by the name of Lawson Craddock has won the hearts of everyone watching the race. Crashing on the first stage, the Education First Drapac Cannondale team rider has continued every stage with a broken scapula and a face full of stitches. And he's promised that for every start he makes in the Tour, he's going to donate $100 to his beloved Alkek Velodrome in Texas. A GoFundMe campaign to add to his contributions has already raised almost $40,000. Chris Froome, well, he's still there, but he also crashed on the first day and was 53 seconds behind a lot of the week. Now I'm not sure where he is. Today at the end of stage six, Greg Van Avermaet from Team BMC holds the first in the GC, with American TJ Van Garderen, also a BMC rider, in third. It's going to be interesting. So meanwhile, we do have a show for you this evening, a new show. Since we're talking racing, I caught up with someone who has such a different and unique perspective on becoming a pro that I couldn't pass up the opportunity to share it with you. Sean McBride went over to Belgium by himself. He entered races, he made a few dollars, and he kept racing. Then he came home. And he did that twice more. As in Three's a Charm, only it wasn't. What is charming is his perspective on these adventures and his advice to young riders who think that the only way to the top of the podium is through a Cat 1 license these days. After we talk with Sean, I welcome back IIHS's Russ Rader to talk about the new helmet study conducted at the Virginia Tech Helmet Lab. When Russ and I last spoke, he told us that the study was being conducted, and last week the first results were released. As more and more helmets are tested, it seems that a new testing standard might be the result. Finally, I talk with Titanium Joe. That's not his whole name. It's Joe Seghetti. But that's his website, titaniumjoe.com. And he's the guy who supplies amateurs and professionals alike with titanium tubing, as well as helping aspiring young builders with specialty welding kits. So we're jam-packed tonight. Let's go off to the West Coast and catch up with Sean McBride about his adventures in bike racing. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You seem to have a very interesting story to tell, one that might just speak to a young rider who's thinking about becoming a pro. So our friend, I don't know how you know Paul Skilbeck, but I know him from a bunch of different shows that I've been to, and he's been there at the same time. I want to talk to you about what you did as a young man and some of the stories you have to tell us.
Okay. I wasn't that young when I did it, just for the record.
Well, it depends on young. You know, young is all relative. Start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up? You started that young.
Yeah, that's true. I did start that young. I grew up in Denver, Colorado.
Okay. And then what made you think bike racing was like a cool thing to do?
It came a long time into life. I grew up, I was mostly just like a dirty skateboard kid, you know, spent all my time skateboarding, maybe not being properly athletic or being super healthy. And then I moved to San Francisco, mostly for skateboarding, I think, in like 95, 96. And then after a few years, just kind of realized like chasing that dream wasn't really what I wanted to do. And I was actually working as a bike messenger in the city and riding track bikes around the city. And I don't know, somewhere in there, just kind of really enjoyed, like, the suffering of the bike and how it felt to kind of push through those barriers and those walls, you know. And once I started getting more and more into that, just kind of gravitated towards racing bikes and met a couple guys who were racing bikes and just kind of went from there.
That's funny. The suffering. My favorite. But yeah. You know what? But I don't think people realize how hard it is to ride a bike all the time, hard. So.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think especially in America, like the kind of common understanding of what bike racing and riding bikes hard is all about is just not really there.
And that's really what I want to talk about. You kind of raced in what I'd call fits and starts. You actually took yourself to Belgium on several occasions, and I know you have some interesting stories about that. Explain how you ended up going from messenger to bike racer to, I think I'm going to go to Europe and race a bike.
Yeah, so when I first started racing, there was another courier dude that somebody just kind of connected me with. Was like, oh, you're racing too? Like, you should talk to this guy. And so I kind of found him. His name was Will. And I don't know how. I think Will actually made the connection just by buying a bike. But there's a shop in the UK called Maestro is the name of the shop. It's a dude named Mike Perry that runs it. And he's been in cycling for, you know, forever, and he's got a couple kids that have raced in Belgium and just kind of has been in bikes and bike racing for forever. And somehow him and Will got connected, and Will was talking to him, and Mike at the time, I think maybe even still, but at the time was kind of like one of the UK's, or maybe even like just in general, one of the largest like Colnago resellers. And him and Will got to talking, and Mike was like, oh, you know, I'd love to have more exposure in the US. And I don't know how in the world Will convinced this guy to give any sort of assistance to a couple like 20 something knucklehead bike messengers that thought they wanted to start racing. But somehow Will made that connection. And like I said, Mike has had a couple sons go race in Belgium, and he's been a part of like British cycling for a long time. And so he had connection with Tim Harris and Tim's partner, Jocelyn, who had some houses in Belgium for cyclists. And like Will was like, oh yeah, you know, if you hang out and ride with us, then we've got this opportunity that we can maybe take advantage at some point. And yes, I raced for like my Cat 5 season. My first year, I think I got like my Cat 3 upgrade or something like that. And then the second year, it was like, oh, I'm just going to go to Belgium because that's, you know, where it happens. So I had the connection through the Maestro shop, and he put me in contact with Tim and Joss, and then kind of just made it happen.
Okay. All right. Hang on a second. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sean McBride, and we're learning a little bit about people who just kind of go off to Europe and try bike racing. So what happened when you got to Belgium?
funny enough, this was kind of before the days of cell phones, Matt. So, or you know, not before the days of cell phones, but before everybody had them quite as ubiquitously. And it was really interesting. Like, Will was supposed to go with me and ended up flaking kind of last minute. And I had the ticket already and I was like going. Everything just happened super last minute. Like, Will didn't give me Mr. Perry's contact information until like probably 2 days before I was supposed to leave. And I think I got Tim and Josh's number finally, like the day before I left. I thought everything was falling apart. And when I got to Belgium, all I had was like an address in a town and then all of my stuff. And somehow the guys at the information booths at the airport got me off on the wrong track. And I ended up taking like a train and then some small local bus with my bike box and my bag. And I actually walked, I think, 3 or 4 miles down some country lane. Just like, is this where I'm supposed to be? And get to this house that's supposed to be where I think I'm supposed to be at. And I'd been told that they were doing renovations on the house, and so may or may not be around to answer the phone, so I should just go there. So, like, I end up at this random house, and I see one set of bike tracks in the driveway, and nobody answers the door, and I'm just kind of, like, sitting on my bike box in the driveway, and eventually some, like, 80-year-old Belgian lady rolls up, doesn't speak a lick of English, has no idea what I'm talking about. And at this point, it's, like, 7 hours since I've landed, and I've just been on this horrific mission to get there. And I just kind of like threw my hands up and was like, well, maybe I'm not going to race in Belgium after boy. I started dragging my bike box down this shady country street, and some Belgian cop pulls up and kind of checking me out, wondering what I'm up to, and realizes I don't speak Flemish and starts talking to me in English. And turns out that somehow I had gotten sent. I was looking for a town called Tiltwingen, and I'd gotten sent to a town called Tiltwingen, which is about 80K, the wrong side of the country.
80K? That's pretty far.
Yeah, it was pretty far, and it was pretty long in the day at this point. I think they were expecting me at about 2 in the afternoon, and I think now we're like 6 o'clock at night. So after a bit more of a hassle and some ridiculous like 120-euro cab ride, I finally ended up where I was supposed to be in the right place. So that was kind of the first day, which was a bit of an adventure. it was only my second year racing, and so I was pretty intimidated having, like, read stories about Belgium and just kind of not knowing what to expect. And when I got to the house, most of the British guys were off. I think maybe some of them were doing the milk race, and some of them just back in the UK. And that was the year that SARS did a number on the Asian race calendar, so the giant Asia team was scheduled to show up at the house that hadn't arrived yet. So when I got to the house, I was there by myself. So really the first couple of days, I just spent, like, trying to figure out what was going on. You know, there's no internet in the house. It was a really tiny village. So just, like, trying to get maps and figure out where the grocery store was and just get myself acclimated was kind of the first few days, week or so.
So do you just show up at a race and race? Without a team, without any support, you just, like, go?
Well, so that's the beautiful thing about Belgium is Belgium's one of the only places in Europe where you can show up and you don't need a team, right? Like, Spain, France, a lot of those places, like, in order to get invites to any of the races or really do any of the bigger races, you have to be a part of an established team. But in Belgium, there's a whole series of races. It's called the Kermesse, depending on who you talk to. And they're sort of like part town festival, part circuit race, part crit almost. You know, it's during the summers, probably a Kermesse every night of the week somewhere in the country. And they're basically capped at 120K, so they're usually right around 120K. Individual regs, so, you know, as long as you have, like, an international license, you don't need a team, you don't need anything else. And, yeah, the Kermesse are great because basically you rock up, and all of the times I went, it was €8 to race. They give you a plastic frame number and a plastic bib number or jersey number, and when you turn those numbers in at the end of the day, you get €5 back. So essentially, you're paying €3 to race.
That's cool.
And it's some of the hardest, you know, craziest racing that you'll ever find. And it's every day of the week, right? You can go to Belgium and race 4 or 5 times a week without even owning a car. So
do you make money at these races, or do they give you prizes, or where do you go from these races? Are you looking for people to pick you up for a team?
You know, for me, like, I started racing a bit older. I was like 24 when I started. So I think somewhere in there, I believe that, like, if all the stars aligned and everything went perfect and I did the best I could, like, maybe there was some way for me to make a living racing bikes. But for me, it was more just like, that's what I was passionate about. That's what I wanted to do. And I kind of felt like, well, you know, if this is what I want to do, and, like, this is the place to do it. But yeah, I mean, the Kermesse pay, I mean, the prizes in the Kermesse are not huge, but they pay like 30 places. So, you know, you're probably not going to get a ton of money unless you're like top five or whatever, at least in prize money. But, you know, you can race for €3 a day. And if you finish in, like, let's say the top 20, I think, like, the second trip I went, I almost never finished outside of the top 20. So every day you're making somewhere between, like, 10 and 15 euros profit racing, which, you know, it's not a lot of money, obviously. I'm not getting rich, but it's enough to, like, buy a couple days worth of groceries and kind of, you know, kick the can down the road and show up at the races a couple days later. And so really all I had to worry about was, like, getting my ticket and a little bit of money for the rent that I needed while I was out there. Kind of most of the rest of it, you could wing it if you needed to. I mean, it would have been a pretty slim existence, but
so I imagine
a bit of money to be made.
I imagine you were your own mechanic?
Yeah, for sure. So the first two trips that I made, I was pretty much everything. Like, you're your own mechanic. You're getting yourself to the races. Like, the first two trips I went on, yeah, there's, like, no real car accessible to us except for occasionally to, like, go grocery shopping if one of the UK lads had a car or some team was at the house or something like this. But yeah, mostly you just kind of pack what you need in your pockets and, like, bring a pump and a spare and, like, hide it in the bush when the race starts and just ride off to the races and ride back. Self-supported kind of the whole way.
What kind of bike were you racing then?
Yeah, so the first year I went, actually, because we had that connection with Mr. Perry in the Maestro shop, I had gotten hold of a pretty sweet Colnago Dream Plus.
Nice.
So I was riding a pretty sweet aluminum bike. Yeah, it wasn't too shabby. Second time I went out there, the team I was racing for back here was the Metro Mint team in San Francisco. It's like a small amateur team. And we had gotten some really good support that year. And so I think that year I turned up on like a carbon Marin mountain bike, or just kind of like a Taiwanese, carbon Marin road bike. Marin mostly makes mountain bikes, but it was like a Taiwanese aluminum lugged carbon tubes, just, you know, Marin branded road bike. And then the last year I went, I was fortunate enough to be on a team at Lombardi Sports, which is actually where I know Paul. Pinarello had given us a few, like, FP6 frames, which at the time were their sort of third or fourth frame down. So the last time I went, I had the pleasure of racing a nice yes, a bit mid-range carbon Pinarello out there, which is actually probably one of the better bikes I ever raced anywhere.
So obviously you wouldn't give these experiences up for anything in the world. Would you recommend this route to a young rider who has some gumption and just wants to try racing in Europe? Do you think that's a good route for a young man or woman?
Yeah, you know, I think that was part of what I think Paul was hoping that I would touch on, and it's a big part of what I've always kind of tried to do. But I think it's the best thing that a young aspiring racer can do. I know that the last couple of years I was racing, the team I was on, Lombardi Sports, had a pretty heavy, like, development focus, you know, trying to bring up young kids. At one point we had, like, one of the more successful junior programs in the country, kind of at a national level. And it was super frustrating to me because you'd see all these kids that, like, 18, 19 years old, like, their whole goal was to get their Cat 1 upgrade and then pretty much find some composite team for Redlands. And it just never made sense to me that Belgium was not that much further to get to. I mean, obviously, geographically, yeah, it's vastly further to get to. But, like, you can find a $600 ticket to Belgium. I was paying 200 euros a month rent. And then as long as I stayed for a month or so, like, it was cheaper to pay your way to race over there almost than it was to stay in the States and race. And it's, you know, how many years in a row did I watch kids scramble to find a composite team for Redlands, go to Redlands, like, maybe finish, maybe not, just ride around in the back, getting their teeth kicked in, and just kind of, like, you know, rinse and repeat for the next 4 or 5 years till they got tired of bike racing. And I always kind of tried to tell these kids, like, look, man, go to Belgium for the summer. Like, save your money all year. When school's out, go to Belgium, stay for the whole summer. And you'll either decide that this is what you want, you know what I mean? Or you'll decide it's not for you. But at the very least, like, you're going to see absolutely what it takes to be successful at the top level of bike racing. And if you're young and American, like, we had, you know, guys that were younger than me that would get plucked out of the house we were staying at. You know, you get young British kids, and we had one young Malaysian kid come, and, you know, 3 races in, he finishes his first race. And by his 4th race, there's some guy from, you know, some older Belgian guy that's like, oh, hey, you know, this team gives me money to support young racers. So, like, I would like to move this kid out of your house and into my house, and we'll put him on this team and kind of, you know, off down the road there. And so there's absolutely a path for those kids. Like, you show up to Belgium young and hungry, you know, 19, 20 years old. You put in a good show. You don't have to win, but you put in a good show and crush at these Kermesse races where you're racing on your own. And the Belgians are just bike racing crazy, right? Like, anything that makes it more exciting or more interesting, they're into. And so the idea of putting a young American kid or putting a young British kid, a little less with the Brits these days because they're right there. But, you know, I mean, the allure of having, like, an international rider on their amateur team is pretty strong. So, like, you can absolutely go over there. And if you put in a good show, find a place to ride and have, you know, a lot of help and a lot of support. Because the amateur teams over there, you know, if you're on a proper team, it's pretty crazy the amount of support even some of the smaller teams give. So
let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Sean McBride, and I'm going to wrap up our conversation with a little bit of your thinking about the American racing scene. You've sort of already given me a good insight into what happens to a young American racer where taking that same pocket of money, whatever it is, and heading over to Belgium, you might be able to get a lot more experience, a lot more racing, a lot more exposure, and not have your teeth kicked in. That's what I just got out of that. So what is the most...
Well,
go ahead.
You'll get your teeth kicked in, but it's a different thing. You know,
different kind of kicking.
I mean, just as an example, right, like, he definitely was out of his prime. But I think the last time I went to Belgium, I showed up at a Kermesse the first day we got there, landed, and Frank Vandenbroek was on the start line. You know, it was the year before he tragically passed away. And so, I mean, like, you really do never know what you're going to get lining up in an amateur race.
Right? Wow.
So never would have in a million years thought that, like, I was going to get to race against Frank Vandenbroek. And so just, yeah, like, the level of racing, you'll definitely get your teeth kicked in, but I think you have a much better chance because you're racing day in and day out against a different group of guys to really kind of see a different outcome every time. So
what made you give it up?
Oh, you know, life got really complicated. Like, I was going to school at the same time I was doing a bunch of racing. Like, I kind of just, you know, did a lot of the things some kids do younger, a little older. And I think the year after I went to Belgium the last time I graduated university. So I finished school and I kind of was really excited about having some free time and just kind of having my life back in front of me. And life just took a couple weird turns. You know, I met a girl and that turned into a kind of tragic thing and took me down a road that I never would have anticipated. And it just kind of got given up by necessity. And then by the time the dust settled and a couple crazy years were over, like, you get so far out of that way of life. You know, when you're not living it day to day, that's sort of the notion of what it would take to get back, or the notion of putting that level of work into it again, just kind of seemed a little unapproachable, but also just a little unintelligent. You know, I mean, by that point, I was like 34 when I graduated university. I had been racing for 13 or 14 years at that point. And, you know, I think I saw where, had I played my cards a little differently, maybe things could have worked out and I could have actually like gone somewhere with it other than just seeing how good I could get. But at that age and with what was going on in my life, it just didn't really seem smart to be like, oh, okay, I'm just going to put everything on hold again and like, you know, dedicate the next 5 years just to trying to be good again when it was kind of just for myself. So
what are you doing now?
You know, I'm taking some more classes, sort of in a different direction, career-wise, and I'm actually back working in the bike shop at the moment, mostly. A couple part-time jobs here and there.
So you do still ride?
Yeah, I do still ride, not a ton. I was actually doing some part-time evening courier work for a while, so I was getting a lot of hours on the bike that way. And now I'm working in the shop, and as silly as it sounds, I've been actually enjoying riding my skateboard a bunch quite a bit lately, so I haven't been riding the bike as much as I did for a while, but I still get out on the bike from time to time, and I still have like a real passion for track bikes on the street. It's kind of what got me into bikes, and so I'm kind of back there, you know, take the track bike out and do some fixed rides in the hills or go do whatever like that a bunch. So,
well, this has been a really fascinating and fun conversation. Let me ask you my three favorite questions. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food, probably pizza.
I was hoping for something a little more unusual, but that's okay. I hear pizza a lot. What music do you like to listen to?
Oh, man. You know, I grew up as mostly like a hip-hop kind of dude, but I, fittingly enough, I guess, those summers spent in Belgium gave me a real sort of guilty affinity for trashy, like, synth-heavy Europop and kind of electronic music. So I like some of that stuff these days, too.
Yep.
Largely up to the time spent in Europe where you're kind of surrounded with it on all sides.
And do you have any pets?
I don't currently have any pets, but my girlfriend has a dog that I'm pretty smitten with, so I kind of consider her mine as well. So I spend as much time as I can having fun with my girlfriend's little dog.
Well, Sean, this was just delightful. And are there ways people can get in touch with you if they want to hear some of your stories and or find out, you know, whether it would be worthwhile for them to take the same kind of plunge as you did?
Yeah, for sure. I don't really have like a website or anything, but if there's anybody listening to this, you know, especially young riders that thinks that that's something they'd want to do, I'd, you know, love to talk to them and encourage anybody to do it. The easiest way to get a hold of me would probably be to just catch me at one of my emails. The easiest one to remember and to kind of throw out into the world probably is macfreshy@gmail.com. So that's macfreshy@gmail.com. Yeah, and if there's anybody out there that has questions, wants to talk about it, wants to pick my brain anymore, they can definitely hit me at that email and I'll get back to them and talk to them about it.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking to me about it. I enjoyed it a lot.
Awesome. Thanks a bunch. It's been a great experience.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a great story. As he said, Sean can be reached at macfreshy@gmail.com. My guess is he has a whole lot of other stories to tell, too. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn the results of the first 30 helmets tested at the Virginia Tech Helmet Lab when we talk with Insurance Institute for Highway Safety's Russ Rader. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Back in April, we spoke with Russ Rader, who is the VP for Communications for the IIHS. At the time, he talked with us about a study being conducted by Virginia Tech to develop a new rating system for bicycle helmets. The results of the first 30 helmets tested came out last week, and I caught up with Russ to find out more. Here is our conversation.
Hi, Russ. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me back.
Well, last time we spoke, you mentioned a helmet study that was being conducted by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which is where you are, and Virginia Tech. And the study was released this past week, and I'd like to know more about it. I have some questions. Tell us basically why you partnered with Virginia Tech as opposed to a different institution, and I think it's something to do with their maybe helmet lab?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have done work with Virginia Tech in the past on safety research, and we were familiar with Virginia Tech's work on testing sports helmets, testing helmets used in hockey and football, for example. And we got curious about whether we could work together on perhaps taking a look in a similar way at bicycle helmets. And since they have the expertise, we went to the experts.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know that all helmets in the U.S., the bicycle helmets, have to pass PSC, which is Consumer Product Safety Commission standards. So what is different, and what kind of ratings did Virginia Tech study? How is this test different? What were they looking for?
Well, when we started working with Virginia Tech, we did we initially started with some collaborative research to look at how helmets are currently tested by the government, what the regulations are. And we began to wonder whether those regulations actually line up with how cyclists are injured in the real world. And what we came up with and what Virginia Tech began testing was to take a look at helmets based on the research into how head injuries actually occur in the real world. And we wanted to look at the most common kinds of head injuries, because one drawback of the government's tests is that they test helmets in a fairly extreme impact, where a bicyclist might sustain a serious brain injury. And we wanted to look at the more common kinds of concussion-type injuries.
Which is more likely. You know, you'll bounce off the ground maybe once and you'll get up and continue riding, even though you probably broke your helmet. So I noticed that of the helmets that were tested, and I want to ask you about the helmets that were tested and how they were chosen, that the first one, two, three, four, six at least are MIPS helmets, which is a new technology. And in fact, it is the first six. And when I say new technology, it's been used, I know, in skiing for a while. Yeah, I think it is skiing and some other. It's multi-directional impact protection system. And obviously not all helmets chosen for this study did have MIPS technology. So what were the criteria to take these helmets, these 30 helmets?
Well, we wanted to do an initial set of popular helmets. And we were interested in trying to make a comparison between helmets that have the MIPS technology and those that don't.
Okay.
And so we basically just started out with a basket full of helmets that represented a cross-section of the market.
Some of them are very expensive. Some of them aren't so expensive. So there was no real specific reason why these 30 were chosen?
Other than looking at the MIPS technology, there wasn't. We wanted a variety of price points, a variety of styles of helmets. And this was our starting point for a program that Virginia Tech intends to continue and test more helmets.
Ah, okay. So if somebody's helmet is not rated by this system and was not tested, is the Institute recommending anything, like changing helmets or finding one of the ones that have been tested?
Well, this is a starting point, and we wanted to give consumers and for our own information to take an initial look at a slice of the marketplace. What we're hoping to do is, as we test more helmets, to give consumers a evidence-based rating of four helmets that they can use when they go out and purchase a helmet. And clearly one of the main findings of this first set of ratings is that this the MIPS technology plays an important role in how well the helmet will protect you.
Well, it's true that what it does is it helps to hold your head in a place where it doesn't rotate within the helmet. And what a lot of people don't realize, it isn't just banging your head on the ground, but it's what happens after in a twisting, which is where the MIPS technology holds your head differently. So are you still conducting more studies on helmets? Are you going to continue this, or is just Virginia Tech going to continue it? How is the Institute going to stay involved, or are they?
Well, we plan to continue to work with Virginia Tech. The Virginia Tech Helmet Lab is going to continue to do bicycle helmet ratings, and we plan to be involved in working with them and publicizing those ratings. We're very excited about it because it's something new for us, and we have a lot of experience with consumer information programs, and we want to extend what we've done for in working with the automobile companies to do the same thing to deliver safety information to cyclists.
So one of the interesting things about this study is the lower the score, the better the helmet. So I'm not sure I quite understand what that means. The better the protection. Let me rephrase that. And that cost is not necessarily the only thing. There are some interesting notes that were made on this. And for those who are interested, you can go to beam.vt, which is virginiatech.edu, and just type in bicycle helmets. And you're gonna find this study. The best available is a 5-star. So you go down 5-star. Nothing was below a 1-star, I don't think. I don't think anything was below a 2-star, which was considered adequate.
Yeah, that's an important thing to point out, is we didn't have any marginal or what we would call not recommended if they didn't get any stars in this first group. So that's the good news. And we also found another interesting thing was that the helmet style also played a role in the performance.
I see that.
So the so-called road helmets, which have that more elongated aerodynamic shape, tended to perform better than those rounded urban-style helmets.
Yes, I see that. That's interesting. I didn't realize that until I started really looking at the shape of the helmets, that, in fact, the sort of the round, what we call the nutcase-type helmet, and the burn is like that, does score higher, meaning that it is less protective. Well, it is very interesting. What else is the Institute doing with cycling right now? Anything else? I know when we talked last time, there were some others that might be going on.
Well, we are doing a couple of different things. We continue to look at the technology on vehicles that perhaps can be utilized to not only detect other vehicles and prevent crashes, but detect pedestrians and cyclists as well. So we're continuing to look at that more closely. And we are also doing some research looking at some of the infrastructure changes that communities are putting in to encourage cycling, to look at how well those things, like separated bike lanes, for example, work to reduce injury risk and crash risk. So that is some research we hope to have out later in the year.
Again, it's Russ Schrader. He's with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, and you do really good work. I appreciate that you take cycling and pedestrians into consideration, and it's not just all cars, even though, for the most part, you're kind of funded by the automobile people.
We are. The automobile insurance companies are the ones who fund the Institute, and our mission is to reduce deaths, injuries, and property damage and crashes on the road, and that includes everybody who uses the road, not just automobile drivers.
Well, we appreciate that, and it's always good to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking to us. It's the Virginia Tech Helmet Rating Study for Bicycle Helmets. It's an interesting study. You can find it online. And Russ Schrader, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Diane. Appreciate
it. Bye-bye.
Russ Rader is the VP for Communications at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. You can find out more about the Virginia Tech Helmet Study at www.beam.vt.edu. And all you have to do is type in /helmet/bicycle, and it'll come right up. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, it's off to Canada to speak with Titanium Joe. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. One of the important pieces of the handmade metal bicycle puzzle is tubing, whether it's steel, aluminum, or titanium. With small builders needing to source tubes, they often can't stock the kinds of numbers some of the big suppliers want to sell. And if you're just starting out, it's nice to have some tubing pieces for practice. So let me introduce you to that guy, the one who helps these builders who want to weld with titanium and who will give you as much advice as you want. Here is my conversation with Joe, Titanium Joe Seghetti.
Hi, Joe. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You know, my listeners love to know about frame builders, and sometimes we get to chat with those who help frame builders, like you. You make their lives easier. Titanium Joe, tell us about Joe, and I hope I get the pronunciation of your last name correct. Seghetti?
Yeah, that works.
What would work better?
I always say it's like spaghetti without the P. It's just Seghetti.
Seghetti.
It's a Hungarian name, and if you speak to somebody who's from Hungary, they say it's Seghetti. And I'm like, okay, sure.
Just make sure that you get the Joe right. How about that? Joe's easy, right?
Sure.
Okay,
yep.
So tell us about you, where you grew up, and your relationship with cycling that then became what you are and what you're doing today.
Well, you know, if somebody told me, you know, 25 years ago what I'd be doing today, I wouldn't believe them. So I grew up in Ottawa, Ontario, you know, like any other Canadian kid. I played hockey and a whole bunch of other sports. And growing up, I just once I got out of high school, I kind of just picked up whatever jobs interested me. You know, I was just interested in sort of paying the bills. How did I get to where I am today, you know, selling titanium? It was almost just a bunch of flukes. You know, I just started selling titanium on eBay, you know, and then people were sort of coming out of the woodwork saying, that's awesome, you know, there's no place we can sort of buy titanium just one piece at a time. That's kind of what led me to selling titanium. The bike builders, a long time ago, somebody suggested to me that I go to the North American Handmade Bike Show because it's a lot of sort of smaller builders that do custom bikes. You know, they build frames for customers, and you know, they need titanium for a bike every now and again, but they certainly don't need to keep, you know, a warehouse full of it. And then so when I went to that bike show, must have been, I want to say maybe 15 years ago, you know, a lot of the builders were very welcoming, first of all, and they were saying that they didn't really have a source, and that whenever they got an order for titanium frame, you know, they kind of had to scramble and find the tubes. So, you know, I kind of approached them all and said, if I carry this stuff, will you buy it from me? And they said, you know, that would be awesome. So I started saying, tell me what sizes, tell me more, tell me what you need. And so I started to make an effort to, you know, carry the stuff that the builders needed. And I still do that. You know, this past year or this past show in Hartford, you know, I walked around and spoke to many of the builders and just said, is there something I could be carrying that I'm not, you know, that you would love for me to carry? And that's kind of how I build my inventory, is what my customers are asking for.
Well, let me back up a second. I want to ask you a little bit about this eBay thing. I know most of us have done something, whether we've bought something, sold something, looked for something on eBay. And so how did you actually have titanium to sell on eBay? Where were you sourcing titanium at that time?
In the beginning, it was just sourcing scrap titanium.
Oh.
You know, that old expression, one man's scrap is another, or another one man's garbage is another man's gold. And it was sort of like that. I was able to find titanium drops or, you know, offcuts that were completely usable for somebody that's just, making a small, project.
Huh.
They didn't need to buy like a whole sheet or a whole mill run of tubes. I was able to source that and just sort of put it on eBay. And then customers started saying to me, can you get this? Can you get that? Back then, it was before I was selling to the bike builders. I was actually selling to the guys that were doing BattleBots.
Wait, what were they doing? What were they?
BattleBots, those fighting robots.
They were really?
And they had to stay within a weight class. So titanium was, important.
Sure, it's light.
It helped them to stay light. They needed something that was going to take the abuse of the other robot that would be attacking. And titanium was great for that. And also, it always it works great for TV because titanium gives off brilliant white sparks. Titanium's used in fireworks and also, the sparklers. That's what sort of gives that brilliant white spark. So that was great for TV. So it was kind of like hot commodity for these BattleBots guys to be able to buy bits and pieces of titanium.
Wow. Who knew? Who knew? Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Titanium Joe, Joe Seghetti. He is in Ottawa, and he supplies bike builders with titanium. He's not the only supplier. You do other things on your website. Can you give us a quick sort of primer on titanium itself? People always ask, is it, I don't know, I can't remember all the different specifications, but is it this as opposed to that? Seven uses one thing and Moots might use something else. So tell us a little bit about the metal itself, other than the fact that it gives off great white sparks.
Well, titanium's sort of known for being high strength, lightweight metal. It's non-magnetic. It's got excellent anti-corrosive properties, so it's used in the ocean for and any other sort of highly corrosive environments, because it will just withstand it. One of the ways of testing titanium is with acid. So it's just a very durable metal. That's sort of the biggest point. And in the past, titanium was really expensive, hard to source, and a lot of machine shops didn't want to touch it because they were afraid of wrecking their tools. But through sort of time and education and trial and error, titanium's used in a lot more things today than it was 20 years ago.
So let's talk a little bit about what you actually do offer to the bicycle industry. So you offer welding kits. You start with a beginner kit, you move up to something like an intermediate and an advanced, and then finally a deluxe combo kit. What do those different kits contain, and who would buy what?
Well, when we were at the show this year in Hartford, we've been selling to bike builders and, frame builders for years. Kind of get the idea that some of the guys are better at welding and some of the guys are better at, making certain parts. And a lot of these builders started off, learning. A lot of them, went to the United Bicycle Institute.
Right.
So I saw they had a booth, and I went over and talked to the guys over there, and I said, "What do you think about the idea of bicycle practice welding kits?" And they said, "That would be so awesome, because so many times our students are asking, what can we practice on? It's not like they can just go in their garage and get titanium,
Right, right.
And they don't want to buy brand new titanium and then practice on it and, you know, maybe wreck it. So part of our business has always been recycling, right? Recycling and reuse. Instead of chucking it out, can somebody use this?
Sure.
So we've put together these kits, and we worked with the guys at UBI to sort of come up with, you know, what they'd like to see in a kit or what the students would like to see in a kit. So the beginner kit, you know, comes with more or less three tubes, one that would make up the top tube, one that would make up, let's say, the, you know, the seat tube and the down tube. They can kind of make a triangle. So they have to miter cut it and weld it. And so we have different sizes of kits. And that's more or less just for price. You know, if somebody doesn't want to spend $250 on a beginner kit, you know, and then that would allow them to build four of those triangle sets. Let's say they just want to spend $75, and then, you know, they can just build one or two triangle sets. And then the next kit, the intermediate kit, would introduce the bottom bracket and the head tube, and the head tube being the thicker walled, so that introduces welding a thin wall tube to a thicker wall tube, which is a new challenge. Then when they sort of master that, they can go to the advanced kit, which includes, you know, top tube, seat tube, head tube, down tube, bottom bracket, seat stay, chain stay, and dropout, which once they've mastered that, you know, they've almost built the whole, they've built the whole frame.
Right, right, other than the fork. Yep.
Yeah, so I always suggest, I think on our website too, you know, this is for guys that either used to do it and just want to brush up on their skills, or they're really handy and they think they can just kind of teach themselves, or they've already gone to UBI and they just want to practice. If it's somebody that really needs more than just practice kits, then we say, you know, go take the course at UBI. You know, we'll gladly supply these kits to anybody that wants to buy them. And, of course, the deluxe kit is somebody that knows in advance that they're going to buy the beginner kit, then the intermediate, then the advanced. If you buy a deluxe kit, you get all three, you know, and then, of course, you get your best savings.
Sure, sure. Wow. So you don't just serve the bicycle market, and we talked about the bots somewhat, but you also offer not just tubing, you offer titanium in other shapes and sizes. Who else is buying titanium from you on a sort of a basis that's larger than, say, the bicycle market? Do you have a specific industry that looks to you for their titanium?
We sell a lot into the racing industry. Really, titanium's used in high-performance stuff.
Okay. Stuff is good.
You know, if you want something, you know, to go fast and be really light, of course, that's racing. Well, that's titanium, right? You want something that's going to outlast everything else because it's going to be sitting in the ocean. You know, that's titanium. So it's a really, the best description is it's a high-performance metal.
So one of the other things you offer is jewelry. Are you making this yourself, or is somebody in your organization?
No, we usually just use that stuff for local customers, like, right, because I'm actually in Kingston, Ontario now, a couple hours from Ottawa. And so it was just more for, you know, we got this warehouse space, it's 5,000 square feet, and we hadn't grown into it when we first moved in. And I was like, asking myself, what are we going to do with this sort of space up front? You know, if you walked into another building, you might see a couple of lounge chairs and a coffee table with some magazines, you know, like a little waiting area. I'm like, nobody really waits to see me, so that's not a good use. And we know that people are going to come through the door and say, what do you guys do here? So I thought we should have titanium, something hanging on the wall, or, you know, and I thought about getting bicycles in here, titanium bikes, but really it's just that would have been a big investment to get titanium bikes to just have them sitting in here for people to kind
right.
of look at. And so I thought, well, you know, our some of our suppliers already make titanium jewelry, so we checked with them, and, you know, it was pretty easy for us just to order it in and kind of have it here on display. And then, of course, sometimes we'll sponsor a charity event and they'll ask for some gifts, and we're like, well, we can't just send them a tube, you know, so
probably not.
Titanium jewelry, and it's just kind of a nice way to introduce ourselves. They're giveaways mostly.
Sure.
You know, we'll give a gift to a golf tournament, or, you know, if a customer, one of our customers, you know, they have an annual crawfish boil, so they ask for some gifts, and we'll send them some T-shirts and some titanium jewelry, and, you know, I guess that's probably a really nice gift, you know, if you're just at a company picnic and you get some titanium earrings or a titanium ring. But, yeah, we don't make the stuff here. We don't make that.
One of the things on your website is a machine shop service, living with an engineer who builds bikes. I know about all these machines, and he grew up in machine shops. So what are you doing with your machine shop? What kind of services are you offering, and to whom?
Okay, well, this maybe that was a little misleading. We don't have a machine shop here.
Oh, okay,
never
mind.
What we do is we have local machine shops in town. And that's more for the customer that says, I need a tube, but I want one end threaded. Can you guys do that? And, you know, for years we were saying, no, you'd have to contact a machine shop. Quite often we would refer one of our customers who is a machine shop. And so we're referring our customers to our other customers, and we still do that. For instance, we got contacted by Cirque du Soleil, and they wanted us to make something. So we just contacted one of our customers that's a machine shop.
How cool is that?
You know, we put them together, and, you know, they ordered the titanium from us, sent it to the machine shop that we referred them to, and, you know, it was a win-win-win.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we don't offer machine shop services to take business away from other machine shops that are our customers. In fact, we try to direct our customers that need machine shop services to our customers who are or have machine shops. And, you know, we have a local shop here that does small jobs, but mostly we just refer our customers to our other customers whenever possible.
So let me ask you a political question. Are you being affected by tariffs right now?
Well, titanium already has a tariff, 15%. And, you know, maybe many of our American customers don't know this, but we pay that tariff so that it's a seamless purchase to our American customer. You know, we pay the tariff and we pay the fees getting it to them. So there already is a tariff. I'm hoping that it doesn't increase. I'm hoping that, you know, titanium kind of flies under the radar as far as that goes. It hasn't impacted us yet. And honestly, you know, I think the tariffs are just going to affect the price for the end user, because there's a lot of titanium in the United States coming from other parts of the world.
Right.
China, Japan, you know, Ukraine, Russia. So if tariffs are put on that stuff, it's only going to increase the price for the, you know, the American customer. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen. The majority of the American titanium goes into aerospace, and it's hard for the small business owner to get his hands on it. We do get some American titanium here as well, you know, and We'll ship it to our customers, but hopefully the tariffs don't bother us.
I have a weird question, because it just occurred to me when you said Kingston that last week I had somebody on my show who lived in Kingston. Do you know Brent Curry from BikeCad?
No, I don't.
Isn't that weird?
That's interesting. What's the name of the company?
BikeCad. So his organization is the one who offers bike builders the computer-aided design website, so you can go out and design the bike.
Well, and you're networking, you see?
Yeah, see, I'm networking everybody.
No, I'm writing that down, and that's it. Brent, you said, right?
Brent Curry. And all you have to do is listen to last week's show, and you'll learn all about BikeCad. That's really funny.
That.
Okay, well, that's
awesome.
Good. So what does Titanium Joe do when he's not working?
Well, we're a family-owned business. My wife and I have 6 kids.
Oh, my goodness.
And we're pretty busy.
I guess.
We're a pretty busy family. We're all athletic, and so, you know, we're doing things with family, and, of course, we all exercise, and we like our toys, and we like the outdoors. So we have, you know, bicycles and ATVs, and, you know, we go to the beach, and we try to spend a lot of time outside.
this has been really interesting. And what I really like is just sort of your kind of magnanimous way of looking at your business, that everybody is going to win, 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 win. And that makes me feel really good. I like that. I like that a lot. So how can our listeners find out more about Titanium Joe and your services and your products and maybe try one of your little kits?
Well, definitely look us up online, titaniumjoe.com. That is .com is the site where we sort of that's our main site where we have all the bicycle tubes and bicycle kits, and you can certainly get a lot of information there. Or feel free to pick up the phone. I always love talking to my customers, as well as, you know, my son works here and my nephew works here, and they're the other guys that answer the phones. So feel free to give us a call.
Okay.
We're pretty old-fashioned that way. You know, yeah, you can email back and forth, and it's nice to have things in writing, but sometimes it's also nice to just pick up the phone and, you know, kind of go back and forth for a minute and a half to get the answer you need.
Right. So I always ask my guests three questions. Here they come. What's your favorite food?
Junk food.
There you go.
Like fast food, pizza, you know, McDonald's. It's a horrible habit, but that's my weak link.
What music do you listen to?
Mostly my truck is on country music. Sometimes I'll switch it to, you know, pop. Anything but rap. My kids put on rap and it
makes you crazy? Yeah, I know what you mean. And do you have any pets?
We have three labs, three dogs.
Nice. Nice. All girls?
Yep, all girls.
Nice. So I guess we'll see you in Sacramento at NABS.
I hope so, but I'm not certain that I can make it there because, as I was telling some of the builders, the North American Handmade Bike Show falls right, usually, in our spring break. And I don't know if I want to have the conversation with my wife about how I'm not coming on our family vacation.
Ruh-roh. Yeah.
Unless, because I'm going to a work thing.
Maybe we'll go to Sacramento for our vacation.
Well, that's not a bad idea. And she might be open to that. But, you know, it depends on the date. And if I can, I certainly will. But we're definitely going to have a booth there. And if I'm not there, then, you know, possibly my son or my nephew, we will be there. But if possible, I would love to go. It's my favorite show of all the shows that I go to. It was so fun last year, or this past show in Hartford. I loved it.
Everybody seemed to love Hartford. It's one of the few I've missed, unfortunately, because we were at Builders Ball in Boston earlier, and so we didn't want to make two trips to the East Coast. You know, we're in Cleveland. But you know what?
Yeah.
If I don't see you there, I still appreciate so much that you spent time talking with me today. We will stop by the booth and maybe drop off a little Outspoken Cyclist memento for you. How would that be?
That would be awesome.
Well,
thank you very much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. You have a great day. Thanks a lot.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Titanium Joe is one of the anchor sponsors of the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. So even if Joe himself isn't in Sacramento next winter, and you're interested in seeing what is available to you from them, you can stop by the Titanium Joe booth and say hello. So I'd like to thank Joe Seghetti, Russ Rader, and Sean McBride for a most interesting and entertaining show this evening. Thank you so much for listening. Please remember to subscribe to our podcast. You can like our Facebook page, and you can check us out on Twitter at Outspoken without an E. If you like us a lot, a quick say-so at your podcast app would be most appreciated too. So I hope you have a great week. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.